Welcome to a special edition of Alpha Trader. Aaron Task and Stephen Alpha coming to you at the start of the Thanksgiving week. Obviously, highly shortened week for the markets. It's still a lot of action, a lot of activity to talk about. And full disclosure, at the end of last week's episode, we were done recording, and I said to Stephen, you know, I think we're forgetting something big here. I don't know. There's something nagging at me we haven't talked about in a while. And it was Bitcoin, which has been on a huge move in recent months, really, crossing 18,000 over the weekend. So to help explain all this and give us some insight on where we are and how we got here, we are joined today by Dan Held. He is currently growth lead at Kraken, which is one of the largest and oldest Bitcoin exchanges. Dan's been in the crypto space for many years, and he's worked at five crypto companies, founded a couple of them. Dan, welcome to Alpha Trader.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So as I mentioned, it's been a huge move for Bitcoin, passing 18,000 for the first time last week since its all-time peak in December 2017. And I think many of us in the financial media remember the last time we were here, three years ago, and there was a lot of frenzy around Bitcoin, and there was a lot of coverage of Bitcoin. What do you think is the biggest difference between this latest move here in 2020 and what we saw in December 2017?
That's a great question. And, you know, I've been around in the space for 8 years and I've been through three of these cycles. When I first got into Bitcoin, it was worth $10. So it's pretty wild to see how far it's come. And with this cycle, it's very, very different than the other three I've been in. This one in particular has the rise of institutions coming in. Bitcoin being recognized as that gold 2.0, that thesis has really taken a hold. And that was my original thesis when I got in back in 2012. But now we're seeing these very large macro traders like Paul Tudor Jones, and we're seeing large institutions like Citibank and JP Morgan writing research where they see Bitcoin's, they see an appropriate price point at $100,000 to $300,000 per Bitcoin. This is in stark contrast to the other previous cycles where Bitcoin was largely disregarded by the existing financial institutions. And now they're starting to embrace that gold 2.0 narrative. And I think it's because of, during COVID, different governments across the world and central banks engaged in fiscal and monetary policies that were largely, very heavily geared towards money printing and things that would potentially dilute the value of their local currencies. And Bitcoin, given its 21 million hard cap, stands in stark contrast.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there. And I really like the idea of gold 2.0 and want to talk more about that. Let's just talk short-term price action. We're talking here a mid-morning Eastern time on Monday, and Bitcoin's off a little bit at 18,300 and change. Near-term, there's been a lot of talk about, we're going to new all-time highs. Do you have a thought on the near-term price action in Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I've been looking at these charts for 8 years, and I'm not sure if I can, tell you exactly where it's going. But certainly the macro tailwinds that Bitcoin has are phenomenal. We're also coming off of some Bitcoin-related moments that typically signal the start of a bull run, that is post-halving. So Bitcoin's issuance schedule, Bitcoin's issuance of new Bitcoins over time, follows this very precise schedule that is known in advance. Every 4 years, the number of newly issued Bitcoins in each block is reduced in half. What that means is that essentially Bitcoin's capped at 21 million Bitcoins that will forever be printed. That's the maximum amount. And they're being printed until that 21 million limit. And that essentially happens over a very long time period. So I think when we look at the typical macro cycle for Bitcoin itself, the halvings represent a very important moment, because the newly issued coins drop in half, which means there's less selling pressure. And that usually leads to the rise of a bull run after, as it has done the previous few cycles. So we've got that. We've got the macro environment. But, more locally, I think we're seeing a snowball effect occur, like locally, as in the last few months, we're seeing a snowball effect occur where folks like Paul Tudor Jones and Citi and JP Morgan, right. And these are starting to really compound on each other. Then you've got the rise of like PayPal. So PayPal, Cash App, Robinhood, you can buy Bitcoin with your traditional brokerage now. And so this is very different than how it used to be, where you'd have to transfer money to, Kraken and go buy Bitcoin at a spot exchange. Now you can buy it with your broker that you're familiar with. So there's a lot more demand, less supply. And I think that's some of the basics here in terms of what the, you know, short-term setup looks like.
Right. I should also note, you know, Fidelity, they set up a new unit to let their clients invest in digital assets. And you mentioned PayPal, letting US users buy, hold, and sell a range of cryptocurrencies. And I should also note, and you mentioned the snowball effect, got me thinking about Ethereum has also been on a huge tear, sort of in tandem with Bitcoin in recent months. For the uninitiated, and I count myself among them, can you give us a quick 101? What's the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum?
You know, that I'm not sure if I can succinctly do that in 30 seconds, but I'll try. Okay. So Ethereum was, let's see. So Ethereum was created as the idea of like being a world computer or a decentralized app platform. That was the original marketing material that they put on their website. And so Bitcoin was created to be a gold 2.0. Ethereum said, how about we take that blockchain technology and build a decentralized app store, essentially. So instead of Apple or Google, you know, the App Store or Google Play Store, you would have the Ethereum App Store where you would require no permissions from governments or platforms to run your application on the Ethereum network. That narrative over time has changed quite a bit. Blockchains inherently have very, very narrow use cases. You can't just sprinkle a blockchain on it and something magically become easier to use or more valuable. Blockchains, like any other technology, have trade-offs. And so they found early on with Ethereum and Bitcoin that there are scalability trade-offs. Blockchains are very, very poor at scaling. This is a good thing because it preserves what makes them valuable, which is decentralization. Now, Ethereum recently has kind of pivoted more towards Bitcoin's direction as being a money. So the short answer is that Ethereum started out being a world computer. I think that's what they should focus on. Now they're kind of a blend of world computer plus a money.
I wanted to just turn back to Bitcoin quickly here. It's kind of one thing for Paul Tudor Jones and Stan Druckenmiller, who are iconoclastic and inflation hawks, inflationistas, so to speak. They've been bullish on gold over many times over the years. It's kind of one thing for them to show interest in Bitcoin. It's a whole different story when Friday, the CIO for BlackRock's fixed income business, Rick Rieder, also kind of gave his approval of Bitcoin, saying it's better than gold. You can't pass around. It's a lot easier to pass around than gold bars. So like I said, one thing for Paul Tudor Jones to be bullish on Bitcoin, a whole different story when somebody from BlackRock says it. Do you worry that this wave of acceptance, that at least in the short term, Bitcoin could be kind of set up for a significant pullback?
Yeah, I get where you're coming from, which is, are we at the top of like a bullish sentiment? You know, I think we're just getting started. I think, of course, we're going to see some drawdowns. Bitcoin is historically very volatile. So we would be remiss not to see a 20% or 30% pullback sometime. I'm not sure when. Let's put it this way. If I could time the markets well, I'd be a trillionaire. But, you know, and that's where you have some like some very funny Bitcoin cultural values like HODL. So HODL is holding on while the price fluctuates a lot. So right. Bitcoin's very volatile. I think we're definitely going to see some drawdowns. But structurally, I think Bitcoin is very well set up for this to represent the beginning of the bull run. And I totally agree with you. It's one thing for Paul Tudor Jones to be into it, another thing for BlackRock to come out and talk about it. You've got negative interest rates on the horizon, which already exist in some countries. You know, you see this giant misallocation of capital in the markets, and you know, where do people find a return? And when you look at Bitcoin, if you look at like how it improves your Sharpe ratio in your portfolio, and with these bigger, more well-known folks buying in, they've reduced career risk, which now make it acceptable to add to your portfolio. And you've got increased liquidity in infrastructure like Kraken and other exchanges in this space. We are one of the largest spot exchanges out there. You know, we're starting to see a really, really phenomenal foundation for, I would say, one of Bitcoin's biggest bull runs.
Just one more on the kind of the institutional angle. There's one person who hasn't kind of thrown his hat in with Bitcoin, and that's Ray Dalio. One of the reasons that keeps him from liking it is he thinks if it gets too big, governments are just going to outlaw it. And you had some very interesting things to say about that at the end of last week in regards to whether governments can or cannot eventually outlaw Bitcoin. I was wondering if you could talk about that a bit.
Sure. So yeah, Ray Dalio, by the way, you know, we all really, I mean, I'm a big fan of Ray Dalio, and I think given enough time, he already has started to question the system and question the decisions that have been made by central banks. And I think it's only a matter of time before he finds Bitcoin. He probably just hasn't spent enough time reading into it. That's typically how this works, is most folks dismiss it because it sounds like funny money, and then they start to research it and they realize, wow, this is actually really, really cool. When it comes to if Bitcoin gets big enough, will governments ban it? You know, I think there's just at first it's a very dismissive way to look at something. An idea that has come is you can't really stop it from eventually actualizing. You can, so for example, and there's a few things that I dived in on in my newsletter article that came out last week. What I wrote about was, can governments kill Bitcoin? And when we look at how Bitcoin is set up, game theoretically, it becomes very unlikely that governments could ban it. And here's why. One, Bitcoin is very decentralized. So the architecture with Bitcoin mining and nodes is set up to be very censorship resistant and resistant to attack by governments. That's why Bitcoin uses so much energy, and that's why it's so slow. It's built that way to resist a government. Now, as Bitcoin grows in size, governments become more aware of its impact on the world and impact on their ownership over their money. Governments will start to feel threatened naturally because Bitcoin does compete with their local fiat currency. The problem is Bitcoin, you know, governments move very slowly. Once Bitcoin is actualized and realized as a threat, the ownership level in certain countries might be 20 to 30% of the population. You can't ban it then, because as a congressman or a president, you're not going to get elected if you ban it, because 20 to 30% of your population won't vote for you. So you start to see this weird game theoretic setup where Bitcoin ownership now gives these people skin in the game votes to make sure that Bitcoin survives.
Right. And you wrote in that post, which I found fascinating as well, and I would encourage all our listeners to read it, that furthermore, trying to ban Bitcoin will increase its visibility. This is commonly called the Streisand effect, a social phenomenon that occurs when an attempt to hide, remove, or censor information has the unintended consequence of further publicizing that information, unquote. In other words, if the government bans Bitcoin, more people who maybe haven't caught on or are aware of it would say, like, wait, what are they banning? What is this thing? And they'll get interested. So I think the idea that the governments might ban Bitcoin, I think is, I don't want to call it a straw man, but it's maybe a step too far. But I have always been of the mindset that if Bitcoin ever really did present a threat to the US dollar as the world's reserve currency, that the US government might do something to restrict its usage. And this gets into obviously policy weeds of the ways they might be able to do that through the Fed or Treasury or other mechanism, the banking system, whatever it might be. But I'm curious if you've heard anything from the Biden administration, the incoming administration, about their views on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general that either gives you concern or makes you feel more encouraged that there's going to be even greater adoption.
Yeah, that's a good question. So a lot of people think that Bitcoin is this Wild West unregulated currency. Now, the Bitcoin protocol, you can send money to anyone. There are no restrictions. And if you custody your own Bitcoin, no one can take that away from you. So on the protocol level, Bitcoin has no regulations. Now, on the fiat to Bitcoin level, there are many regulations. For example, like Kraken, we have CFTC, SEC, IRS. They've all issued regulations around Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is very heavily regulated as currently. Also FinCEN. When we look at the Biden administration, if they will be better or worse, you know, Steve Mnuchin was very, very anti-Bitcoin. So you couldn't get much worse than him. Now, I don't really have a good read on. Supposedly, Biden is eyeing a few candidates for different roles that might be more pro-Bitcoin, but I haven't seen anything definitive yet. And given that Biden is he's basically anti-capitalist. And he's looking at, you know, raising taxes across the board. I don't really see him embracing Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is a very, very free markets type protocol. It's not, it's antithetical to any sort of socialist leanings. So I don't see him being a fan of it. However, like, Biden's going to surround himself with a cabinet and folks that will want to build a brand for themselves. I mean, that's what this is all about. They're not actually here to serve their constituents. They're here to serve themselves. And so they're going to want to think about how to position themselves, and they probably want to be more pro-innovation than be a really hardliner, we're going to protect the big banks. So they're put in a bit of a quandary where they need to look pro-technology and pro-innovation and pro, you know, newcomers. So in that regard, Bitcoin might slip by.
Interesting. And so obviously one of the names that's been talked about for Treasury is Janet Yellen. And I don't recall her talking much about cyber currencies when she was Fed chair, but you probably follow that much more closely than I did. Do you have any sense of what Janet Yellen's views are on cryptocurrencies generally if she were to become Treasury Secretary? Because you said it can't get much worse than Mnuchin. But yeah. she, coming from the Fed, she would probably have, certain points of view on it that might not be very pro.
Bitcoin. It's actually pretty interesting to see, like, for example, the St. Louis Federal Reserve branch, they have some pretty cool research that's come out that indicates that the Fed really has a good grasp as to what Bitcoin is. And Jerome Powell said that Bitcoin in 2019, he said that Bitcoin is a speculative store of value. I mean, that's pretty wild. Back when I was in Bitcoin, when it was worth $10, we were considered nuts. We were considered crazy. And now you've got the chairman of the Federal Reserve saying Bitcoin is a speculative store of value is pretty wild. Janet Yellen in particular, I don't have a good read on her affinity towards Bitcoin or not. That's a great question, but I haven't really dug in on that.
And speaking of Yellen and Powell, I was wondering if you could explain this phenomenon that's been talked about a lot, central bank digital currencies. To me, the whole thing at Bitcoin is it's decentralized. If a central bank comes out with a digital currency, that's not at all comparable to what Bitcoin is. In my reading, is that right?
That's exactly right. I think a lot of people saw when Bitcoin came out and they thought it was just a digital currency, but it's not that. It's decentralized. And so when central bank digital currencies became popular, people mistook Bitcoin for competing with those. But you're right, they're completely centralized, and they're actually, I consider them somewhat of an abomination. You're talking about people being able to bank directly with their central bank. Look at what that means. I mean, this is insane, right? Like, you have a government then that is in complete control of the economy. It could censor individual transactions. It could tax a transaction. So for example, if you pay for something, it could automatically remove sales tax. It could also penalize certain people of a certain race or region. It's pretty scary. It's about 1984 on steroids. I don't even think they thought you could do things like that in 1984. So central bank digital currencies are being touted by central banks as, hey, this is innovative. It allows us to be more efficient. Well, that's that's a bit of BS. It's more about its complete control over every single transaction in the economy, which is, I think, in very stark contrast to what Bitcoin is, which is the absence of a centralized control.
All right, we're going to take a break here, and we'll be right back with more with Dan Held. You're listening to Alpha Trader. Welcome back to a special FOMO edition of Alpha Trader. Our guest is Dan Held. He's currently the growth lead at Kraken, the largest and oldest Bitcoin exchange. He's been in the space nearly a decade, worked at 5 crypto companies. And Dan, I want to go back to what you mentioned at the beginning of this podcast and what you said got you into Bitcoin at the first place, this idea that it's gold 2.0. And I think a lot of folks on the outside have looked at Bitcoin as an alternative to the dollar or a place to speculate with money that you don't want in the stock market. What do you see as Bitcoin's relationship to gold? Because I think a lot of the philosophies that you referenced on this podcast, sort of a libertarian, anti-government point of view or reason a lot of people like gold, maybe the same thing appeals to those who like Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Are we reaching a point where people are saying, I want to be in Bitcoin or gold? Or do you see that coming?
Yeah, there's a couple of things to unpack here. One is the, I would say like the in aggregate, like the world's population affinity for products that are anti-government. So that'd be gold and Bitcoin, right? I think with COVID, a lot of people have been critical of the government's response, whichever region they're in, about how they responded to the virus. This has led people to start to question. And then also the bailout programs were very poorly targeted. For example, some of the U.S. bailout programs bailed out very large companies while millions of small businesses failed. So I think that people are starting to have a moment where they start to question the nature of the reality, where they start to question their government's policies and why it's beneficial to them. Pretty soon, they're going to start questioning their money. This happens in these sort of really, you know, very, very rare events like a pandemic, where people, it shocks people into thinking, into zooming out and rethinking their world around them. So when they start to venture out and look at alternatives to store their value that's outside of the government control, you've got Bitcoin and gold. Now, gold is the quintessential store of value. It's, I don't think I have to explain it. Everyone knows what it is. Everyone's seen it in movies, represented as that. Bitcoin is a digital version of that. And here's what's similar. One, you don't have a central controlling mechanism. So gold is found across the world in mined, but there isn't a central ledger that controls all gold. You can mine gold in your backyard if you found some. You can buy gold from someone else. There isn't a centralized factor there. Now, there is a little bit of centralization with the custody of gold, but that's not too big of a deal. Bitcoin was built similarly to gold in the fact that it's not centrally controlled. You also have a very limited issuance schedule. So gold is somewhat rare on Earth. Now, gold in space is very plentiful, which makes the gold standard not scalable for a civilization that moves beyond Earth. And so when we look at gold's issuance, we know that it's that essentially not a ton of gold is going to be found tomorrow. We know that it is scarce. Bitcoin plays into that, but takes it to a whole nother level. So Bitcoin has a 21 million hard cap. No more than 21 million Bitcoins will ever be created. What both of those represent are trustworthy monetary policies. You don't have to trust a centralized issuer that they won't manipulate their monetary policy, that they won't change it when under pressure. We've seen the Fed, and I mean, the Fed is talking about having a mandate to solve global warming. Did you guys see that?
Yes. It's even more head scratching than central bank digital currencies.
It's insane. I mean, yeah. We have truly lost the plot in terms of our economic leaders who lead our economies and how they think through it. I mean, we have seen politics become so intertwined with that, you really can't distinguish it anymore. And that base money should have zero politics involved. And so that's where Bitcoin was created. And by the way, Bitcoin was planted in the middle of the 2008 financial crisis.
Yeah. Thank you for saying it. Because I, you know, as you were talking about, you know, people questioning reality and the value of money today, you know, we're not that far from the financial crisis where a lot of people realize, like, wait a minute, what is going on here with the financial system? And the bailouts then were obviously very heavily tilted towards the banks, and none of the CEOs of those banks that almost ran the global economy into the ground suffered any consequence material that we could see for their actions. So yeah, I do think it's probably not a coincidence that Bitcoin has risen from those ashes, and certainly the pandemic has, I think, reinforced what, as you mentioned, people's questioning of government and reality. And we mentioned your thread the other day about governments banning Bitcoin. You had a great line in there about the fiat currency is only, quote unquote, backed by the faith of those who hold it. In other words, the faith in the governments that issue it. And not to get political or conspiratorial, but obviously we're living in a moment where half the country doesn't think the election is over, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, faith in all our institutions is under threat right now. And, you know, maybe the dollar is the last thing to fall. I don't know. I don't want to go down that, you know, it's Thanksgiving week. Like, you know, I don't want to go down that path, but you could kind of see it, you know, down the road somewhere. But so again, is that a reason for me to own Bitcoin now? Like, is it beyond that in your mind? I'm guessing it's the latter, but I'll put it to you.
Yeah. So to kind of round out my thinking with gold versus Bitcoin too, because a lot of folks might not, you know, they might go, oh, well, I understand gold. Why would I want Bitcoin? So gold doesn't have a predetermined supply schedule. We don't know how much gold will be found. We hypothesize it will be scarce. Bitcoin is perfectly predictable. It's the most predictable thing in our universe in terms of a monetary policy. Anyone can run a Bitcoin node and evaluate every single ledger balance and the future issuance schedule, which is pretty beautiful. It means that, you know, in terms of information being incorporated into the economy at the base level, we can absolutely trust the monetary layer. when it comes.
Right. So it's not like who's the next Fed chairman, what's their Treasury's policy, how much fiscal stimulus is there going to be with the new government, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Isn't it crazy how we sit here and we watch like the facial expressions of Jerome Powell or something on TV?
Right. Body language. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. We're looking for body language and people are like, did he have tea or coffee this morning? That might dictate. I mean, it feels a little
briefcase.
Yes, exactly.
It's like, it's like we're shamans. It's like he's a shaman and we're trying to figure out what smoke color is going to come out of the stack. You know, it's pretty ridiculous when you look at it from like an objective view of like, what should an economy look like and how should it be predictable? So Bitcoin is that next evolution in money. It's the final evolution of what money always should have been, which was completely decentralized, completely known and trustworthy. And that's where I think Bitcoin, when you look at the existing system and you look at, well, who do I trust? I would encourage everyone to go down their own rabbit holes of evaluating how many layers of trust they trust in with their money. With Bitcoin, you can hold it directly. You don't have to tell anyone about it. You can hold it on a USB drive. You can hold it in your head. You can memorize it, or you can bury it in the backyard on a steel plate. You know, that sort of money and Bitcoin is, you know, you can acquire it from your next door neighbor or an exchange like Kraken. It's a really, really different type of beast than gold, where gold is very physical and you have to move it around. It's very hard to move. You can't divide it very easily. And it's really hard to verify. You know, most gold bugs don't carry around like a spectrometer to go check that their gold's valid. Right. Whereas Bitcoin, you can do that with very, very minimal effort. So I think in this world where people start to question their government, they start to question decisions that are made, and investors, especially the wealthy, and this is where my opinion differs from a lot of Bitcoiners. My unpopular opinion is that Bitcoin will serve the wealthy much more in this cycle than they will retail, where the wealthy will see it as a way to escape their financial system. Because as socialism creeps across the world, they will look to store their value somewhere that's not seizable. And Bitcoin is one of the very few places that offers.
Right. We've certainly seen that from, you know, wealthy people in Russia and China, other places like that, trying to get their money out of those systems. And Bitcoin has been a vehicle for that.
Aaron, I would even say something like Julian Robinson owning thousands of acres of land in New Zealand, you know, with an escape plan, you know, the plane's gassed and waiting just in case. You hear stories like that too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And right. If we only had that kind of money, we could do that too. But we don't. So let's bring it back to investing in the few minutes we have left. And Dan, I really appreciate your time and insights here today. I don't consider myself a gold bug, but I've always kept, you know, somewhere around 5-7% of my portfolio in gold or gold assets, basically as a hedge in case something really goes wrong with the financial system. And over the years, it's served me well. So there's a couple of questions that I want to ask about this. A, what role do you see as Bitcoin playing in someone's portfolio today? You know, I would say a traditional investor who's probably got most of their assets in the U.S. in stocks broadly, some fixed income, maybe some gold. Like, what do you see as the role of Bitcoin in a portfolio today?
Bitcoin does represent that safe haven asset. But what's kind of crazy about Bitcoin is that it's a safe haven asset like gold, but has an extremely much higher upside. The volatility is much more intense. So when you add it to your portfolio, it typically improves your Sharpe ratio. Depends on the other assets in your portfolio, but Bitcoin is when I first got in, it was $10. So it's up 2000x from there. So not only do you get the exposure of a safe haven asset like a gold, but you've got it's a little bit more fun. It's got a little bit more upside to it. Bitcoin's only around, was it a $400 billion market cap today? If it competes with gold, gold's at $9 trillion. But Bitcoin also competes with other monies and other store of value assets like real estate. Now, I know real estate has a function of actually being a home and has some utility there, but largely real estate is an investment. So Bitcoin competes with all of those. At a $400 billion market cap, Bitcoin is, I would consider very, I think there's a...
Right. Underrepresented, yes. Underrepresented is probably the word. So what would your advice be to someone like the co-host of this podcast, who currently don't have any Bitcoin or Bitcoin assets, to get involved today after this huge run? It doesn't sound like you think, you know, the train has left the station or it's too late or other cliches like that. What would your advice be?
Yeah. So, you know, first and foremost, only invest in what you know. If you want to invest in Bitcoin, read up on it. There's a lot of great resources that you can tap into. For instance, like if you go to danheld.com, you read Planting Bitcoin. Planting Bitcoin is your 0 to 1. It'll get you from understanding why Bitcoin is created to why it's valuable and why it solves a problem. But yeah, understand it, get to know it. When you're comfortable with it, then I recommend investing into it. I personally have basically my entire net worth in it since 2013. So it's something to where I'm strongly convicted in it. I think for a rational investor, not one who is extremely risky like myself, you know, maybe something like 1% would be, I think, you know, now you've got exposure to Bitcoin. If Bitcoin 10x is in price, now it's worth 10% of your portfolio. If it goes to zero, you've only lost 1%.
Right.
So something very small. It's you would be remiss not to have it, though. I think especially in this time, especially given where Bitcoin is at in its market cycle, you know, a very small allocation is what I'd recommend.
And if I could just ask you one more question about kind of the recent price action before we go. The 2017 bull market was almost more of an ICO craze, initial coin offering craze. And in order for folks to participate in that, they had to buy Ether or Bitcoin to help drive the runs there. Are you seeing any kind of like return to that this year? Has that been happening?
Yeah. So in the 2017 bubble, there was a rise in these things called ICOs, initial coin offerings. So new coins that were being created. And in order to purchase them, you had to buy Bitcoin or Ethereum and then transfer it to go purchase those coins. Now, we don't have that in this cycle. There's not nearly the speculative fervor around new assets. I think this cycle is very different in terms of it being a moment when Bitcoin truly shines. This isn't the rise and fall of a bunch of other speculative assets. This is Bitcoin's original purpose and what it was created for. It's waited since its inception 12 years for this moment. Bitcoin has waited for the moment where people start to seek a safe haven asset as their governments start to engage in very poor fiscal and monetary policy. So I think that's why this cycle is so special. You've also got the de-risking by institutional folks coming in. I mean, again, I can't emphasize enough how much we were considered outsiders. You know, back when I first got in 2013. In 2013, there was only a dozen of us at the Bitcoin meetup in San Francisco. This included the founder of Kraken, founders of Coinbase, founder of Litecoin, founder of Ripple and Stellar. And to see how far it's come, to see the recognition that Bitcoin has now is truly, it's a bit of a shocking thing to where we were so libertarian fringe group back then, that to see it become the mainstream narrative is thrilling and also a little scary at the same time.
Right. Yeah. I hope the fact that we've decided to talk about Bitcoin today is some sort of contrarian signal that represents a top. Yes. And I only say that half joking, but to be fair, we've talked about Bitcoin with a number of guests over the last year, and several of them have been bullish. John Najarian, I recall, over the summer was very bullish. Yep. JC Peretz, All Star Charts. These guys are traders. One comment I do want to ask you about Mark Dow, who's a macro trader, made the observation that Bitcoin didn't really help you during the big sell-off in March, that it's not a non-correlated asset to the stock market. So what do you say to this idea that Bitcoin is just, quote unquote, another risk asset, that it's going up because there's a lot of money out there and people are already filled up on stocks and they're worried that, you know, stocks overvalued. So where else can I put my money? Is there any truth to that, or does that not concern you?
So yeah, Dow was talking about the around March when Bitcoin dipped and the mainstream markets dipped as well. Gold dipped in that same time period. That was a liquidity crisis. So as people were getting margin called, as the markets were dipping, every asset sold off, even safe haven assets. So I don't think it's fair to compare and to go point at that moment and go, oh, see, Bitcoin isn't a store of value, because gold, the quintessential store of value for 4,000 years, also dipped during that moment. When we zoom out and look at how Bitcoin has performed in 2020, over the last 2 months, it's largely decoupled from the market. So you could claim that, you know, Bitcoin is moving with the market, you know, during the middle of 2020, but at the later half of 2020, Bitcoin is truly moving on its own trajectory. It is not at all correlated with the S&P. So, for example, those folks who like TradingView, pop in there and throw up the S&P versus Bitcoin over the last 3 months, it's very, very, very much moving independently. So,
right.
Yeah, I think what the sell-off you saw was a liquidity crunch. I don't think that's indicative of it not being a safe haven asset. Longer term, and especially over the last couple of months, I think we're starting to see the market price that in. The market's starting to price in, oh, wait, we've got this magical thing called Bitcoin that I can store on a USB drive in my house and that no one can seize. I mean, this is a pretty wild proposition. And more folks are, and that snowball effect, like I mentioned earlier. And the price also acts as a signal. The reason that you and I are talking about it right now is probably because the price is around 18,000. If Bitcoin stayed at $1,000, no one would be talking about it. So the price acts as this signal to the market that it's becoming validated and trusted, and more people hear about it, more people buy in anticipation of the value going up, and that builds the FOMO cycle.
Right. We're certainly in that now. And I would also note, Bitcoin has decoupled from gold in recent months too. Gold has been selling off as Bitcoin has kept going up back towards approaching its all-time high, I should say. So last question from me at least, and I again appreciate your time here and all the explanation. So I mentioned JC Peretz at All Star Charts. He's been a bull on Bitcoin in recent months. He's a trader, a technician. He wrote something over the weekend, and I want to get your response to it. He wrote, quote, "Owning Bitcoin is no different than buying a stock or ETF. It's just letters and math. Everyone thinks there's some secret sauce to the cryptocurrencies, but overthinking can be incredibly dangerous. If you grant it more prestige or mystery than it's worth, then you become part of a cult. And if you lose that ability to think clearly about your investments, it becomes a religion. And what happens is that you throw risk management out the window," end quote. So now, you mentioned you have your entire net worth in Bitcoin. I don't want to call you a cultist or say it's a religion. But what is your response to this idea that Bitcoin is, it's quote unquote, it's just another financial asset and you should treat it as such if you're an investor?
Bitcoin is distinctly different from any other asset. I don't know about, when was the last time you guys took physical delivery of your stock certificates? Yeah, exactly. And even if you had those, you'd have to rely on the company in order to redeem them, and the government could go to the company and say, don't redeem those. Really, the only other asset that Bitcoin compares to is physical gold delivery. You have self-custody where if you have the asset yourself, you are truly in the ownership of it. There's very few, even your home, you don't truly own because the government is like, cool, you live there, so I'm going to tax you on it and you can't take it with you if I really started to penalize you heavily. So Bitcoin and gold are the only two, seizureship resistant, self-custodied assets that you can truly hold. So I think that demonstrates that he doesn't fully grok or understand what Bitcoin's value prop is. I think it's very disingenuous to compare it to stocks. Now, when it comes to the religious nature of it, sure, there's a fervent following of it. I mean, can you imagine what we believed in? Like we challenged the assumptions of state and money for a decade. Like what if we're right about this? This will be one of the biggest moments in human history. So, of course, there has to be a cultural value of a very tight-knit community to keep that spirit alive. I mean, I've seen my net worth rise exponentially and drop 80% 3 times. I don't know how many other people have gone through that. So for that faith to stay alive, because faith is the only thing that keeps it all running, including fiat currency, to keep the faith of Bitcoin alive, you had to have strong cultural values. Bitcoin survived things like a civil war where part of the Bitcoin community fractured off. It survived that. It survived attacks by competing cryptocurrencies. So Bitcoin is a very resilient community, and that cultural value, I would say, yes, it's a little bit religious in a way, but that is a good thing because it preserved Bitcoin's values all the way through to here, and those values are what make it valuable.
Right, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask, do you know who Satoshi Nakamoto is, or does it matter anymore?
The golden question. Well, that's what's so beautiful about it is that Satoshi had the maturity of staying pseudonymous. We never figured out who he was. By the way, he self-identified as a he. We never figured out who he was, which was brilliant because he felt that he was a centralized risk to the protocol, that if the government found him, that they could potentially hurt it. So he removed himself from the equation. That was the only way to play the game. And Satoshi has never touched any of the coins that he mined himself, which, by the way, anyone was free to mine. He just wanted to support the network. So Satoshi is sort of like this is where we could make it a little bit quasi-religious, where Satoshi is a bit of a he's a Prometheus type character. He gave human fire, but then he's been penalized for the rest of his life. He's never touched, and his stash is worth, makes him like one of the 10 wealthiest people in the world.
Wasn't there a rumor earlier this year that there was some movement from an address that he was thought to be associated with, and it sent Bitcoin down about 10%?
The title was a clickbait title that said Satoshi era coins move. Not Satoshi's coins. So
era, right, yes.
The era. Yeah, it's the era in which he mined, but his coins that he mined have a distinct pattern to them, to where, and this is hypothetical, we don't actually know if that's Satoshi's coins. It was just this miner started day one and they operated for a certain amount of time, and it seems probabilistic that it is Satoshi's. So to be clear, we don't know how many coins Satoshi has, but it's probabilistic as to how many he might. And he's never moved those once, not a penny. And we're talking tens of billions of dollars worth, which is pretty wild. Satoshi built Bitcoin. He was a very ideological person. I mean, this was something more than money. This wasn't about money for him. It was about giving people freedom. So yeah, Bitcoin is religious. It's got a very intense community, rightfully so. And yeah, if they're right, it's going to be kind of wild.
All right. Well, we will give you your freedom back. Dan Held is currently growth lead at Kraken, a longtime player in the crypto space and a true believer, to be sure. And Dan, we'd love to have you back as this story obviously is going to continue into 2021. Dan Held, thanks very much for being with us today.
Guys, really appreciated the conversation. Had a ton of fun. Thanks again.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. And happy Thanksgiving, everyone. You've been listening to Alpha Trader.